This is no ordinary train. This is the legendary Orient Express, witness to many strange adventures and foreign intrigues. From Istanbul to Calais. This is no ordinary passenger.
Monsieur Poirot is a detective.
This is the world's most celebrated crime fighter.
I take a professional interest in crime.
Agatha Christie's brilliant Belgian detective.
Belgians? I always thought you were French.
Albert Finney is Detective Hercule Poirot. This is no ordinary mystery.
Can't touch nothing.
This is Agatha Christie's most perfect crime. Murder on the Orient Express. Starring the greatest cast of suspicious characters ever involved in murder.
The murderer is with us now.
You can identify the murderer?
Lauren Bacall.
I mean nothing of the kind. I mean there was a man in my compartment last night.
Monsieur.
Martin Balsam.
She did it.
Thou shalt not kill.
Ingrid Bergman. Jacqueline Bisset.
He makes it sound like a poison.
Jean-Pierre Cassel.
Monsieur Hercule Poirot.
Sean Connery.
How did you know?
Beddoes.
John Gielgud.
Mr. Beddoes.
He did it. The butler did it.
Wendy Hiller.
You never smile, Madame de Francis.
My doctor has advised against it.
Anthony Perkins.
It seems like I'm kind of incriminating myself.
Vanessa Redgrave.
Not now. Not now. When it's all over, when it's behind us.
Rachel Roberts.
And I...
Richard Widmark.
Let me show you this.
Michael York.
He did it.
The who's who in the whodunit.
Ladies and gentlemen, we now come to my own reconstruction of the night of the murder.
Murder on the Orient Express.
Hello and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Detective Rob Kelly, and joining me this week to talk about the 1974 classic Murder on the Orient Express, directed by the great Sidney Lumet, is our pal, Chuck Coletta. Chuck, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thank you very much for having me. That's a great pleasure and honor to be on again. Thank you. It's
a great honor to have you. You are, of course, one of our most frequent commenters over on the website. You always provide great context and the king of YouTube links, I like to think of you. You always manage to find something relevant to what we're talking about. And so, obviously, the remake of Murder on the Orient Express, directed by Kenneth Branagh and featuring what constitutes in 2017 an all-star cast, is coming into theaters in just a couple of days. So, I thought this was the perfect opportunity to talk about the original. This was something I reached out to Chuck about months and months ago because I wanted to do this. I love this movie. I love the original Murder on the Orient Express. It is one of my top 20 favorite movies. It is a movie that I get nothing but pure joy from when I watch it. I've seen it dozens of times at this point. When did you first discover it, Chuck?
You know, I must have watched it as a kid sometime on television. I can't remember a time when I didn't know the ending or what was happening. There's an episode of Cheers back in the 80s when Frasier spoils the ending of Citizen Kane and Murder on the Orient Express and a bunch of other things.
Oh,
and
right, I knew it right, by right. Then. I remember that, yeah.
So I can't remember a time. It must have been shown on television sometime when I was a kid, those Sunday night movies or something like that.
Did you like it from the beginning? Do you remember?
Oh, I did. It's even now when I've seen it before and you know who everybody is and what's going on and how it's all going to end, I just enjoy those stars all there together. And it's just a light, fun movie. And if it's ever on TV, I'll just sit there and watch it. I don't care about the spoiler.
Right.
I don't worry about that anymore. But I really just... I have always liked it.
Yeah, I mean, that is something worth commenting on, is that for a movie where, after you already know the ending, it still holds up. Like, it doesn't matter, you know? It just doesn't matter that you know the end. And for anybody who has not seen this movie and is planning on seeing the remake, we are going to do our best to not spoil the ending, even though the book is, like, 90 years old at this point, and the movie is 40 years old. We're going to do our best to not spoil it, and then we will have a spoiler section at the end of the show where we will talk about the ending in specific. But like I said, I don't think it matters. Like Chuck said, I don't think it matters that you know the ending to this movie, because it's this version is so delightful, so entertaining, that even after you've seen it, you're just along for the ride, and it's just fun. And you mentioned, of course, an all-star cast, and this is truly an all-star cast. We've got Albert Finney playing Hercule Poirot, and the Martin Balsam is the director of the line, Hercule's buddy. But in this movie, you've got Lauren Bacall, Ingrid Bergman, Jacqueline Bisset, Jean-Pierre Cassel, Sean Connery, John Gielgud, Wendy Hiller, Anthony Perkins, Vanessa Redgrave, Rachel Roberts, Richard Widmark, Michael York, and Colin Blakely. Not to mention George Koulouris, who was in Citizen Kane. I always like to mention any actor that shows up from Citizen Kane. He plays the doctor in this movie, which is a delight
scene. That's right. You're right. You can't think of a movie, or I can't think of a movie, that has, you know, that much of an all-star cast. You've got, you know, alumni from Casablanca and James Bond and Breakfast at Tiffany's, and Norman Bates from Psycho is there, and I mean, it's just incredible that all these people signed on for these parts that are relatively small. They only each have a few minutes of screen time, really, when you think about it. It's amazing.
Right. According to what I read, is that Sidney Lumet, who was on a hell of a streak in the 1970s. I mean, Sidney Lumet is one of the great directors to ever shoot a movie, but man, he had just finished, a couple of years earlier, had finished Serpico, and then he did a film called Love and Molly, which is not one of his more famous ones. Then he did this, and he followed this up with Dog Day Afternoon and Network. So, right. I mean, he was on a hell of a roll.
I was doing a little research for our talk today, and I saw a quote from him where he said that if it hadn't been for Murder on the Orient Express, he didn't think he would have been able to direct Network, because was trying to learn how to be a little bit lighter and how to be a little bit more fun in some of his movies, because he was known for these sort of gritty street realistic movies. There's a really interesting movie that I never saw until about a week ago called The Anderson Tapes.
I've never seen that one, with Sean Connery.
With Sean Connery, and it's introducing Christopher Walken as the kid, believe it or not. And it's a gritty heist movie where everything kind of goes wrong. And I think the reason why Sean Connery worked with Lumet so many times is that he let him sort of move away from James Bond. There's another great film from the mid-60s called The Hill, if you've never seen that.
I've never seen that one either. It's a really
prison
good
drama,
one
yeah. A military prison drama. And Sean Connery is as far away from James Bond as you could possibly get. And when other people were only seeing him as this action hero, Sidney Lumet gave him a chance to really do some acting and sort of, you know, be a character actor. And I think he appreciated that, and that's probably why he agreed to do this relatively small part in Orient Express for him.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I saw the quote that I saw was that Lumet booked Connery first, because Connery at the time was the biggest star, and he figured if you get the biggest star, you can get everybody else after that. And that's exactly how it worked. And it's funny that you mentioned that's probably the reason they worked together so many times. They did four films together.
Right.
Is that, of course, you know, Sean Connery is in Murder on the Orient Express, and as James Bond, he was on the Orient Express
yes.
in From Russia with Love.
yes, that's true. I forgot about that. You're right.
Well, this film has an amazing – this is like a not to strain the train metaphors too heavily, but this film is really like a Grand Central Station of film history when you think about all the connections that are made here. And there's dozens, and I won't get into all of them, but like just as a couple for instances. This movie features, of course, as we just said, Lauren Bacall and Ingrid Bergman. Humphrey Bogart's, the two women most associated with Humphrey Bogart were Lauren Bacall, who was his co-star in so many movies and his co-star in real life, and Ingrid Bergman, who he, of course, appeared in Casablanca. This film features Martin Balsam and Anthony Perkins, both from Psycho. So you've got that going on. There's a line that Sean Connery has where he talks about trials, where he says, you're judged by 12 men, sound and true. It's a good system. And, of course, he's talking about the trial system, which is, you could say, is 12 Angry Men, which starred Martin Balsam and was directed by Sidney Lumet. So.
Right. And almost all of these people, even some of the people who are maybe lesser known today, but like Wendy Hiller, you know, she's was a great dramatic actress and did Bernard Shaw, and she was an Oscar winner herself. You know, it was just a murderer's row of,
no
of acting talent. You know, it's amazing. I don't think you could get a movie like that today. You know, you would have to have Tom Hanks and Tom Cruise and Julia Roberts and Denzel Washington. They're trying to do that a little bit with this new film, but it's not the same. You know,
no.
Johnny Depp and Michelle Pfeiffer are great, but they're not Ingrid Bergman and Sean Connery.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he said that Lumet really lined up an amazing talent. I mean, a little bit behind the scenes stuff is that, apparently by the early 70s, Agatha Christie, who was still alive at this point, had decided she was no longer going to sell any more rights to her books. She was unsatisfied with some of the film adaptations that were done in the 60s, and so she had just decided, forget it, we're not going to do it anymore. And so the producers of this movie, one of them was the brother-in-law of someone related to Agatha Christie, and so they used that as a way to get to her, and they sort of pitched her really heavily and said, no, we're really going to do this right, because to this point there had never been a film adaptation of Murderer on the Orient Express, and that got her to relent finally. And of course the finished film, Agatha Christie later said, is her favorite adaptation of any of favorite film adaptation of any of her books. She appeared at the film's premiere, and it was her last public appearance before she died in 1976. So she was, you know, she kind of went along with this, and then of course was rewarded because she was very happy with how this is. I don't know how you can't be. I think this is like sort of everything that I think you like about Agatha Christie. I have not read many of her books. Now you've read the original novel, right?
Right. This is the only one I had ever actually read, and basically because I had seen the movie so many times. And I always sort of thought, well, I've seen the movies, and, you know, what's the point of reading it? But the novel is remarkably close to the film. They've changed a couple of the names of the main characters, some of the suspects, some of the clues are different, but it's basically almost the same. You could read it in an afternoon. It's very short, and she sets it up with, you know, she gives you a diagram of where everybody is on the train, where their compartments are, and she lays out the evidence, point one, point two, point three, and I mean it's more of a puzzle than anything. I guess you could call it a novel, but it's more of a puzzle, an intellectual exercise. And I was surprised. Again, doing some research, that Agatha Christie supposedly is the best-selling author in the world.
Yes.
After Shakespeare, and maybe she even may beat him at this point now. But it's amazing how she is an industry, and this film, Murder on the Orient Express, spawned for the next maybe decade. There were these English Agatha Christie all-star adaptations like Evil Under the Sun and Death on the Nile,
right.
A couple of other ones. This is the best one, though, I think.
Yeah, this is the only one with Albert Finney, who I love. I'm just such a huge, huge fan of Albert Finney. He had not done a movie for 3 years before he did this, and his previous film was ironically a movie where he plays a detective called Gumshoe. Or a guy pretending to be a detective. But apparently he was, you know, he really was, he's to this day, because of course he's still with us, is very skeptical of the whole film acting thing. And so he really wants to be on the stage. And it's only every so often that they can sort of lure him back into movies where he does. And normally when he appears in a movie, he's tremendous. He's Aaron Brockovich or Traffic, or he does these little things and he's great. But he is so wonderful as Hercule Poirot. I mean, I saw a review of this film by Roger Ebert where he said that Finney walks around like a crab, And he says it's a great comedic performance, and it really is. There's this wonderful sequence where he runs up the hallway of the train, and he really does move like a crab. I never noticed that before. But his shoulders rock from side to side, and he's got that hair matted down, and of course the mustache, which he wears a little cover over when he sleeps.
Yeah.
He is absolutely fantastic. His eyes are always darting back and forth. Nobody could see me because, of course, this is a podcast. But like his pupils are always going as he's listening to people talking. And you know that he's banking all this information. I mean, he's this sort of brilliant. I mean, when he first is approached by Rossetti, played by Richard Widmark, where he says, "Do you have a light?" and he gives it to him, and then he keeps talking and he says, "Now, obviously, you're trying to just get to know me because you've asked for a light and you haven't used it yet." And Woodmark's character is like, "Oh, Ratchet," is like, "Oh, huh, very good, very good." And that's when he tries to hire Poirot because he says, I'm receiving death threats and I need protection. Right. And it's Poirot that says, "Well, no, I'm not interested in the case. I'm kind of retired. I don't want to do this." But before we get into the movie itself, there's a couple other things I wanted to mention about the making of. This movie was shot by Jeffrey Unsworth, who, if anyone who is familiar with the Superman Movie Minute show I do with Chris Franklin, that film was shot by Jeffrey Unsworth, so you know it was, it's beautiful looking. The screenplay is by Paul Dean, who wrote 4 of the 5 original Planet of the Apes movies, as well as Goldfinger.
Right.
And the music, now this is, music is something I rarely mention on Film and Water, just because I tend not to mention it. I feel like I don't ever notice it unless the score is really good, like it's a John Williams or something.
Right.
But the music here is by Richard Rodney Bennett, who was Oscar nominated for his score. He worked with Lumet again on Equus a couple of years after this, and later did another Agatha Christie movie called Murder with Mirrors. The score of this movie is phenomenal. It opens with that sharp sting, and it sets up the whole idea of the Armstrong murder, which is of course a gloss on the Lindbergh baby kidnapping. But I mean, the music in this movie by Bennett is just killer. It really is quite eerie. It sets up, for as much as this movie is fun, that whole opening sequence where it shows you the crime through all the headlines and the photographs, it really is quite eerie. It's got that weird kind of like ghostly sound to it. It really sets the tone perfectly.
Yeah, and there's the sequence when the train is leaving the station, and it's a waltz. I can't hum it, but it's this very light and uplifting waltz. And supposedly, I saw in one of the documentaries about it, Bernard Herrmann saw this, the great composer for Hitchcock, and he was livid when he saw that. He said, "This is a train of death, and it should be dark and mechanical." And he just totally didn't get the tone that they were going for. And if I could just go back for one quick second, you were talking about Albert Finney. He is totally unrecognizable in that Poirot disguise. I know what Albert Finney looks like, and I just don't see him in that character. I don't know what they did or who did the makeup, but it was extraordinary. And he's probably 40 years old then, late 30s, early 40s, and he's playing probably mid to late 60s, and it's a complete transformation. And the other thing
he was 38 actually when he did this.
Wow. And the original cast, he wasn't even the first choice. Lumet originally wanted Alec Guinness to do it, and he was unavailable. And then the actor Paul Scofield, who was also an Oscar winner, was unavailable. And so, they went with Finney, but they just thought he was too young for it. But he really sells it, like you said, how he moves, and he just seems like an older man.
Yes.
But you're right.
And he's like a bull in a china shop in a lot of ways. Like, he's not terribly concerned with the niceties of the sort of society hoi polloi that he's running with. There's this great scene where he starts questioning everyone, and he questions Mrs. Hubbard, played by Lauren Bacall, who was swinging for the fences in this movie. She's playing big. But we've already established that she likes to talk, that she's a real chattermouth, and chatterbox. I'm combining two words. And he sits her down and he says, "This is going to go great if you can confine your answers to yes or no as best as possible." And he's like, "Your name is Harriet Hubbard." And she's like, "Yes, I was given that name." And he starts, and then he just interrupts her. He's like, "Anyway," and he moves on to the next question. Like, he just completely barrels over her. He is, him and Balsam are so fun together because they're old friends. I mean, this right. movie, I mean, the movie opens with Poirot being a famous detective already. There's an opening scene where he has just finished another case. And the train porter talks to him about it right as the movie opens. So you're like, wow, there's a whole other prequel movie that we haven't seen. All this is going on. But him and Balsam are these old friends, and they are – Balsam looks like he's having the time of his life in this movie. He's just so – him and Finney are great together.
Oh, they are. And Poirot is such an eccentric. And I think what you said about that he doesn't care for the social niceties, that's the exact opposite of Miss Marple, Agatha Christie's other most famous detective, where she is this innocuous little old lady and nobody – and she sort of worms her way in and is very nice and polite. And he's just – you know, he's just this eccentric, odd little man that they don't – that they all – are on their guard about because he's such a famous detective, but he's just so weird that you buy it for some reason. It's a very fine line that he walked doing that role because it could turn into a cartoon. I think Peter Ustinov was kind of a cartoonish figure sometimes when he played Poirot, but I think Albert Finney, heads and shoulders, was the best of all that I've seen.
Yeah, I mean, I could see, like, I was disappointed when I learned that he only did this one film.
Yes.
But then this one came out so well, I could sort of see Finney saying, "Mom, why do I need to do this again? I don't need to."
That's right.
It was funny, I forgot to mention how I first discovered this movie. This was back when I worked at the video store, which I've mentioned a bunch of times. And strangely enough, when this was released on VHS, it was released on two tapes.
Wow.
Even though this film is only 128 minutes, I don't know why they felt the need. They couldn't cram a 128-minute movie on a VHS, but I actually have it on VHS. For some reason, I collect double VHS tapes, like I need to collect more things, but I have this, and I don't even remember where they split it up. They don't. It's not like they, you know, the first tape is 120 minutes and the second tape is 8 minutes. They split it up at like the hour mark each time. But I remembered I watched it for the first time and I fell in love with it right from the beginning. I was like, this is just so much fun. And this is probably something we should mention at the end, but it's in my mind now, is like, you know, I'm sure Chuck, you've seen this. We've all seen this where when you talk about summer movies, right? And people say, oh, the Transformers movies or whatever, this movie is so dumb. And there are people who defend those movies and say, well, I don't want, you know, Schindler's List. I want to just turn my brain off and have fun. Okay, yeah, but you can do something that is just meant to be entertainment, but you can do it with style. You can do it with wit. You can do it with intelligence. I mean, Murder in the Orient Express isn't about anything other than the plot. That's all that it's about. But this movie is wonderful entertainment. And so the idea that a movie that is made only to be entertaining has to be dumb and loud and stupid, that offends me, because I lump this movie in with Superman or Raiders of the Lost Ark, the kinds of movies that are meant to be kind of big, glossy, fun entertainment, but also done with some style. You know, some intelligence, some wit. I mean, there's nothing wrong with any of that. This movie is not about anything other than a bunch of great performances and watching all these actors just ping off each other. That's really what it's about.
Yeah, and you're right about the style, because that's really the thing. The characters are not wearing even real clothes from the 1930s. They're wearing costumes.
Right.
I think the production designer and maybe the costumer was a guy named Tony Walton, who was Julie Andrews' first husband. And when you see Lauren Bacall and Jacqueline Bisset and some of these other ones going through the train station, there's no way you could dress like that in real life. And, you know, but on one of the documentaries, he's talking about how much care they spent in just getting Lauren Bacall's hat the right style and the right slope of the hat. She wears it in the movie for like a minute,
mm-hmm.
you know, as she's walking onto the train. But the care and precision of every little detail. Supposedly the inside of the Orient Express, you know, it was much grander in the film than it was even in real life. They were, you know, polishing the buttons, and they were making sure everything just was exactly like you would wish it would be, but it could never be even in real life. It was the ultimate Hollywood movie to a large extent.
Oh, even from the font choice at the opening credits with the kind of old-timey Art Deco font, and it's shot over this sort of silken background. But yeah, I mean, you're right. All The characters look phenomenal. I mean, Wendy Hiller as the Princess Dragomirov, she looks like the Emperor from Star Wars. I mean,
right.
She's so extreme looking. She's dressed in black. And she has this, you know, chalk white skin tone. I mean, yeah, nobody looks. And you've got Connery with that great mustache. And John Gielgud, who looks like the ultimate butler. I mean, it's like right. If you picture a butler in your mind, that's what he looks like. You know, I mean, and he's got that stiff upper lip kind of thing. And there's that great moment where... What's his name is talking to him. Jean-Pierre Cassel is talking to him, and he's like, what are you reading? And he's like, oh, I'm reading Love's Captive. And he's like, oh, is that about sex? No, it's about 10:30, you know?
That's right. Well, you know, that's right. You know, why would you cast someone like John Gielgud for such a small part? Because the star power just does it for you. You know, you need a suspicious kind of squirrely guy. Well, Anthony Perkins does that, and he's only got a few minutes to sell it, or you need the ultimate butler. You know, this is before he even did Arthur. This is a good 5 or 6 years before Arthur where he won the Oscar. It's the exact right person, exact right huge name for these roles. He's perfect in it, Gielgud.
Yeah, Perkins seems to be basically playing Norman Bates. Had Norman Bates not been arrested for killing his mother. I mean, he's a guy with mommy issues who never gets – he works for Richard Widmark's character. But I mean, he's kind of that squirrely kind of guy. And he takes a great delight in this role. You can see he's really enjoying it. There's a great scene at the end where we see all the characters and there's some celebrating going on. And at one point, Perkins's character just stands up. And he has nobody to hug because he's not part of a couple. He just sort of stands up and just kind of looks around and then sits back down like he's just took his bow. It's great. I love him in this movie.
Yes. You know, I mean, he was, again, it was just the right touch at the right time. There's a scene in the when Mrs. Hubbard is talking about, you know, but there was a man in my compartment, and you know, I've known men in my compartment before. And Ingrid Bergman is sitting there in the background, and you could see her flinch. She's supposed to be this very religious, uptight woman, and she turns away. And it's such a small character moment that if you're not looking at her, you miss it. But you can see that they all inhabited these characters right down to the perfect moment. So I really enjoy just looking around what everybody's doing and how they're interacting amongst themselves.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just on my umpteenth rewatch of it the other day, I was watching the moment where they get into the train cabin with the body. We'll say whose body it is, but with the body. And they're looking at everything going on, and you've got Poirot and Martin Balsam's character, Bianchi, and the doctor. And at one point, they're looking around, and... Poirot thinks that something is trying to be put over on him because he does in this little sing song voice. He goes, "There are too many clues." If you look at Martin Balsam in that scene, he has got a grin from ear to ear as he's looking at Poirot, and it's like I imagine it's the joy you take at looking at a master doing their thing. It would be like watching Beethoven compose. You know, you're like, here's my chance to see this. I mean, I'm watching this world-famous detective detect. Like, you're getting to see something very few people in the world ever get to see. So he looks like he's just having so much fun. And I love, after every sequence where Poirot is questioning one of the suspects, Bianchi always goes, "He did it." He comes to the conclusion, he did it, she did it, he did it. He's convinced every day. And at one point, he literally even gets to say, "The butler did it." He gets to say that line.
And that's, you know, that's like the key. They even show that in the trailer. Like, you know, it's don't take this too seriously. Yes, there is a corpse on this train somewhere that's been stabbed 12 times, but it's very bloodless. I mean, you're not, it's more about the puzzle to be solved for the audience and the reader. It's not... Well, you know, we're not really considering, you know, how terrible this murder is to a certain extent. It's just the joy in the detection and watching him figure it all out. What's going on? And he's right. There are too many clues for this train, right? So.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they establish early on that the person in question who gets murdered is a shit, is a really terrible person. And so when that person ends up dead, you're kind of like, oh, all right, you know, you're not that upset about it. I mean, you want people to get caught because you can't go around letting them kill people, but you're not all that terribly, you know, bothered by it, which is kind of a nice thing. So you really are kind of just like, let's just watch Perot Poirot, I should say. Right. We should watch Poirot right. just do this. And again, I love that. That makes me think of the other scene with Richard Widmark, where he's kind of the quintessential ugly American.
Right.
Because he calls him Poirot. And he's like, Poirot. What?
Yeah.
Poirot. Oh, you're right, of course. So anyway, Mr. Poirot, he just barrels right through. He doesn't care.
Well, you know, and Richard Widmark, again, to talk about perfect casting, you know, he played the villain so many times. And you may have seen, but some of your listeners may have not, there's a great movie called Kiss of Death from the 40s,
so
where
good,
he plays
man.
Tommy Udo, a famous scene where he pushes the old lady down the stairs in her wheelchair. And he's giggling the whole time he does it.
So
and that's where Frank Gorshin got the Riddler. I mean, a lot of the Riddler from the old TV show is based on Tommy Udo. And you're right. You know, we don't, you know, he deserved it. He deserved what he got in the end. And Poirot doesn't seem so upset about it. He's, well, when they find out who he is and what he's done, well, maybe he got his just reward.
Well, it's funny you say that because jumping a little bit to the remake, because I don't know anything. I mean, I'm going to see it because, A, it's Murder on the Orient Express, and I'm just interested. And I really do like Kenneth Branagh.
Me too.
And I like the cast he's assembled. I was a little concerned that Johnny Depp was in it because I'm kind of over Johnny Depp at this
yeah.
point. To me, Johnny Depp is just all about funny hats at this point.
Yeah,
but when
right.
I learned that he's playing Ratchet, which is Richard Widmark's part, and Ratchet is the one who gets it, I'm like, oh, well, Johnny Depp won't be in the movie that long. So I can,
no.
you know, I'm kind of like, oh, okay, that's fine. Not to spoil it for anybody, but I mean,
no.
again, this book is, you know, the book is 80 years old. I mean, it's going to
yeah.
leak out. But yeah, Johnny Depp's role has to be, by definition, pretty short.
Right. And if you watch the trailer, you know, it's a little bit different for the new film is that they show them outside the train and they show him walking on top of the train and somebody hanging from a bridge. So I don't know where they're going to include all this. You know, physical action. But the movie, like this movie, should be very claustrophobic. Everybody's trapped here in this small space. They're all on top of each other. Even at the end, when he's laying out the plot, they are stuffed. You've got, what, 12 or 13, 14 people stuffed into this train car, and they're all shoulder to shoulder. So I don't know. It will be interesting to see how they remake this. The film has been, Murder on the Orient Express has been remade a couple of times since
right.
For TV movies
Alfred
on TBS.
Molina,
and on,
I believe once.
Yeah, but they're not, you know, they're okay, but they're not these all-star productions.
Yeah, they definitely play into the idea that there isn't a lot of space here. Every time somebody opens a door, there tends to be another person stuffed behind the door because they
yeah.
can't move. I mean, there's a one scene where Poirot comes out of a cabin and behind him is the doctor. You know, the doctor's kind of stuffed behind
yeah.
the door, and they kind of look at each other, and because the doctor is sort of got this real fright wig kind of Albert
yeah.
Einstein sort of look to him. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I don't know where they're going to make room for all these action sequences that they seem to be putting in the movie, because this film, this original, doesn't have any of that. It really is. I mean, it opens up on a boat, oddly enough,
yeah.
of all places. It opens up, there's the where they take the ferry over to the train. But once it gets on the train, that's it. We stay on the train the whole time. There is some mention of you know, the train line being snowed in, and that's why all this happens, because they realize that, you know, that's how they're able to discount that Ratchet was not killed by anybody who is not on the train now. They really, nobody could sneak on, kill him, and get off. It's somebody on the train is the murderer, and that's how we're gonna, you know, we're gonna be able to hash this out. But yeah, and you mentioned earlier the sets. The sets are beautiful. It's a real pleasure to look at. It has kind of that old-timey kind of gloss to it. The colors are all very muted, which I like,
right.
except for some bits here and there. It's only actually in the opening montage where they talk about the murder, where you see the headline, Daisy Armstrong slain, and that
yeah.
turns to red, deep blood red. And that's pretty much the only red in the movie. Which I thought was really interesting. Because, yeah, it's the color palette very muted. It does have, it looks kind of like an MGM musical had it been shot in color, you know. But
right.
I mean, it's
right.
it's a very low key kind of. It really is Lumet doing you know, a sort of old timey Hollywood thing. And as you were talking about, you know, he was like Mr. Social Conscience. You know, he did
yeah.
The Pawnbroker and Failsafe and 12 Angry Men, all these serious heavy movies. And here he is kind of just having fun with all these great actors. And it's just such a delight to watch.
It is. And What was the thing I was going to mention? The part about the opening sequence, like you said, is so creepy. And we see these images, and it's sort of like the perfect images from yellow journalism, those headlines and
right. Those.
I mean, you could tell, I'm sure we'll talk about this later, when Poirot is revealing the facts and the key clues that he's discovered. You know, you see a suspect talking, and then you see them talking again. You know, he relit it, he reshot it
yes.
with a different angle, and maybe if you're watching it for the first time, you may not notice that, but it's very dramatic. What he was able to do just by changing the lens, you know, on an actor's face, and it gives you a whole different attitude. I mean, he really was a master of what he was doing. I mean, and you look at his films, you know, Sidney Lumet also did The Wiz, you know, the musical Wiz. And so he was very eclectic when we think of him as this gritty director. But I think if you ask people to name his top five movies or what do you think of most, I don't know if Murder on the Orient Express would come up, you know, next to Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon, which is totally different. You know, he was a great director right up until the end.
Yeah, I mean, his last film was Before the Devil Knows You're Dead with Ethan
right.
Hawke and Philip Seymour Hoffman, and that's a really good movie, and especially – and the thing I like about that movie, not to get too far off Orient Express, but the thing I like about Before the Devil Knows You're Dead is it's a very alive movie. It's gritty, and it's hard-charging, and it is – surprising when you realize it's the work of an 80-year-old man. And
that's right.
There are a lot of film directors, Quentin Tarantino is one of them, who says that he's going to pack it in when he gets too old, because he feels as though that once you get too old, you really can't make good movies anymore. And he has a lot of examples to point to. There are a lot of great directors who ended their careers kind of on a down note, and he wants to go out on a high note. But Lumet is an exception. Lumet kept making great movies really up until he died, and and as you said, in all different genres, you know, I mean, he really could do lots of different things. And so, and yeah, you mentioned I'm glad you mentioned the thing about reshooting the clues, because that's something I never noticed until I saw a making of where he talks about it, where we see all the different suspects have different lines of dialogue. And then during the end of the movie, where Poirot is explaining everything, we re-see those scenes, but they have been reshot with a different lens and a different angle. And it gives the same dialogue a whole different feeling when you see the camera underneath somebody's chin. Before,
right.
you saw it on another side. But here you're seeing it. You know, that's what Lumet brought to it. And I want to say, like, I'm a defender of his. He doesn't need defending. But he's somebody who I just think doesn't get mentioned enough anymore. And you're right. I think this film is like a low-key masterpiece in terms of how fun it is. But you're right. This wouldn't come up on anybody's list of his top five films because he has so many other huge movies.
That's right. You know, he starts off with 12 Angry Men.
His first film. His first film was 12 Angry Men. Imagine that. Unbelievable. Well, we will get to spoilers in a moment, but we should just sort of sum up here. I think this is an absolutely delightful movie. I think of this movie, I mentioned earlier, along with sort of Raiders of the Lost Ark and Jaws, as a movie that I can watch over and over and over, and it just makes me feel good. It's just fun to watch people at the height of their powers, having fun, doing something in real high style with real wit and humor and beautiful visuals, great performances. There's just no flaws to this movie. It's just really fun. And even if you're planning on seeing the remake first or something, check this one out. It is just a delay. And it is now on iTunes. It was not on iTunes for the longest time. I guess now that the remake is out, Paramount was like, geez, we should make some money off of this and put it on iTunes. So you can get it on iTunes. It's not on Blu-ray yet. I'm going to buy it on Blu-ray as soon as it becomes available. But check this movie out. It's just terrific.
Definitely. Two thumbs up for me.
Well, all right. So we're going to play a little bit of music, or maybe some dialogue for the movie. I haven't decided yet. So at the other side of that, we're going to get into spoilers. So if you don't want to know about the ending of Murder on the Orient Express, I would say stop here. And we can move on to next week's episode and go see Murder on the Orient Express in the remake. But if you do want to hear me and Chuck talk about the ending, just stay tuned.
Let's Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? May I respectfully suggest that there should be no talking while Monsieur Poirot addresses you. If anyone wishes to make a statement, he or she can do so at the meeting's end. Thank you.
All right, and we're back. So now Chuck and I are going to reveal the secret ending to Murder on the Orient Express. Chuck, why don't you give everybody the short version of who did it in this movie?
Well, they all did it, yes. Right? That's why it's so memorable, and I think why it's Agatha Christie's one of her greatest sort of stories. She flipped the formula, the mystery formula, on its head. You know, which one of these people, who done it? They all done it. So
yeah, we find out that the connection to the Daisy Armstrong murder, again, which is, her version of the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, was orchestrated by Mr. Ratchet, played by Richard Widmark. Of course, everybody would believe Richard Widmark was a mobster. Totally plausible. And we find out that that's not his real name, and he's on the run. He left America once his associate got pegged for the murder. And we find out that every single person on this train, everyone has some connection to the Armstrong family, some directly, some indirectly, but they all had a motivation to kill Ratchet. And this was their plan from the beginning, was to get together to kill Ratchet. And the idea was they will all stab him to death. And of course, it will be impossible to figure out who did it because there's so many. He ends up with 12 stab wounds, and they stab his pocket watch, which seems to suggest when he was killed. But we find out that that's not the real case either. What they didn't plan on was with a world famous detective, Hercule Poirot, to be on the train at the same time. And because this was such an orchestrated plan, they went ahead with it anyway. Now you would argue maybe you should have waited because
that's
it's
right.
Like, you know, if I was planning on killing somebody and then I saw that Batman was in town, I think I might put the plan on. But, you know, this was 1935. This is very hard to orchestrate. So they just went ahead and did it anyway.
You know, and the interesting thing is that this book, the original novel, came out, you know, right at the height of the Lindbergh baby kidnapping case. So this was – the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped in 32, I think. The novel came out in 34, and the person who maintained his innocence up until he was executed, he wasn't executed until like 35. So this would be – this was almost like a rip from the headlines story, and it must have been, you know, sort of satisfying for people at the time. You know, the most famous man in America, you know, how did his child be kidnapped and murdered? How could this happen? I mean, it was such a media circus, and so it must have been at the time sort of, well, you know, we got him one way or another. We got him, and just like you said before, it's fun just watching Poirot figure out how did they all do it and what's their connection to everyone. You know, if they only hadn't put that Daisy Armstrong they would have all gotten away, I guess.
Right, because he figures it out by he finds that charred piece of note, and then he uses those wax things to melt it, and he sees part of the name, and he figures it out. I love how Finney as Poirot sort of plays with all these people. Some of them are a little craftier than others,
right?
At revealing some things. I mean, like Connery as Colonel Arbuthnot. Arbuthnot. he's kind of like, he's dishonest by being sort of forthright. Like,
right.
He sort of seems like he's admitting something, but he's admitting something to throw Poirot off the trail, because what you find out is he's having an affair with Vanessa Redgrave's character, Mary Debenham, and you find out that that's what he's covering up, because he's got a military career and his wife wants a divorce, and he finds out that that would be a big scandal if it's revealed that he's having an affair. And so, you know, he sort of is pressed to finally admit that. And then when he does, you think, oh, well, he's kind of an honest guy. And you're like,
yeah.
Well, no, he's using his honesty as a decoy for Poirot. And Poirot doesn't really fall for it. And I love the sound design in this movie, because there's this great moment where he questions Connery. And then he says, okay, can you send in Mary Debenham? And they send in Vanessa Redgrave, who looks great in this movie.
Like, oh, she does.
Looks just absolutely gorgeous. And of course, she played Agatha Christie in a later movie called Agatha. She played, and so we see him, Poirot, kind of getting up in Mary Debenham's grill, and we see it from Connery's perspective, and we kind of hear the muffled audio because the door is shut, and Connery gets so mad that he storms in because he wants to protect Mary Debenham. And so I love that. I love the idea that we, for a moment, we see it from Connery's point of view and how upset he's got that that Poirot is getting up in Mary Debenham's face. I think that's a great little bit.
Oh, you're right. And if you read the novel, she's the suspect that Poirot is most interested in. And she has a somewhat bigger part in the book, and she seems to be the one that it's all because he happens to overhear her when they happen to all be on that ferry at the very beginning. Let's wait until it's all over or not now. So
right,
he knows right from the beginning that they seem to act like they don't know each other on the train, but on the ferry they were embracing. But you're right. He does treat each person suspect differently. He's very upfront and forceful with Vanessa Redgrave, and then comparatively, you know, he's very gentle with Ingrid Bergman, who plays this weeping, simpering, you know, I don't want to say religious fanatic, but she's just
she's
so religious and so missionary that she's like visually trembling at every moment. He's very delicate with her. And like you said with Lauren Bacall, he just, you know, okay, just the facts, man. Just stop talking, you know.
I love her in this movie. I love that she has that whole story about she says something about, I forget what the context of it is, but she talks about something that happened 15 years ago. And
that's right.
She's like, 15 years ago, I only would have been 15, which
that's right.
Trying to suggest that she's only 30 years old now.
That's right.
Yeah, she's a blast in this movie. She just rips through it. I mean, she's just, and like the whole, and I like how they all kind of subtly look down on her, because there's a line about where she talks about being married to men being in her room. And
that's
it's
right.
Wendy Hiller, Princess Dragomirov, says something like, well, I can't imagine why there would be men in your room for any other reason other than to get out of your room or something
that's right. That's right. And she's so over the top, and she is this ugly American. And then when you find out at the end of the story that is an act to a certain extent.
Yeah.
She had really been this famous actress. And when you read this, when you read the novel, and if I hadn't seen the movie before, I wouldn't know, but they're always talking her about being very theatrical, or she walks in dramatically, or she with a flourish. And so it's subtly in there that she's playing a part right from the beginning. We never really see the real Mrs. Hubbard until the very end. She's just playing this exaggerated version of herself.
Right. I mean, when he's questioning, what's his name? Oh, shoot. Pierre. And
right.
Pierre, right in the middle of Pierre talking about a mobster. And he's like, he's doing the machine gun. He's like, rah, da, 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 da. And then they pan over and you see Hubbard holding the knife. And she's standing there with it, holding this bloody knife in a very dramatic fashion, as opposed to, you know, like you would pick up a bloody knife in the middle of a murder scene.
That's right.
If you found a bloody knife, you would walk out of the room, go get Poirot and say, hey, I just found some evidence. But instead, she picks it up and stands
there. Right.
So you're right. Yeah, she is very dramatic and stuff like that. And yeah, everybody, I mean, Perkins's character, McQueen, seems to, he even literally says, I think I'm incriminating myself here a little bit, because he sort of admits that he's got kind of a mom complex. So, I mean, and Poirot just says, oh no, I'm not here to judge you. Like, he just kind of let, you know, he sort of,
I've never been married. I'm socially retarded.
Right,
and he's like, starts blurting this all out, you know, and just shut up. You know?
Yeah. He lets McQueen just talk and let
that's
him sort
right.
of incriminate himself. But meanwhile, with somebody like Hildegard, Rachel Roberts, he has to kind of trick her. And at one point he does. He gets her into admitting something where she herself realizes in the middle of her sentence what she's admitting to. Because she talks about all the women that I've, you know, all the ladies I've worked for. And then she sort of freezes because she realizes she's just admitted something.
Right.
And Poirot just kind of moves on. So, yeah, he has to take all these different tacks with all of them. And they're all really highly – it's all successful because they said he's just such a brilliant, master at psychology.
Yeah, my favorite one, the one that's the most different from the book to the film is the Ingrid Bergman's character. She is described as being very meek and mild all the time, but in the novel, there is none of this religious missionary stuff. So you get a clue, and you know that scene is very short. She's only on screen for about 5 minutes, but you know he uses her language. She doesn't. She's has difficulty with the English language, but at the end he uses the word emolument, and
right.
she understands it. And I don't think the first time I saw the film, I got that. Because, you know, once you, oh, that's obvious. She doesn't know how to say nightgown, but she knows the word emolument. But he hones in on the exact right thing of where they start to trip themselves up, or where they start lying. Like the princess starts lying, well, I don't remember my best friend's other daughter's name. You know, it just they start slipping, because you're right, like you said before, they didn't expect him to be there.
Right.
Everything would have worked out fine if they hadn't been snowbound with him. The exact wrong person.
Yeah. Can I tell you, the only reason I even know what the word emolument means is from this movie? Because
I think me too.
There's all this talk about the emolument clause nowadays with who we have as president, because he's in constant violation of the emoluments clause. And the only reason I know that word is from this movie. And it's funny you mention Ingrid Bergman, because she really only has that one big scene. Now, originally, Lumet had wanted her to play, I think, Princess Dragomirov.
Right.
And she turned it down. She said, no, I want to play this other character. I want to play Greta. And Lumet was like, well, Greta's a much smaller role. And she's like, no, I want to play Greta. So he ended up, I think, combining a couple of her scenes together, so she kind of got one big scene. And she ended up winning an Oscar for this movie for Best Supporting Actress.
And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, I looked up who did she beat that year, and she was up against some of, like, the landmark supporting roles of the 70s. She was competing against Madeleine Kahn in Blazing Saddles.
Oh, boy.
And Talia Shire for The Godfather 2.
Oh, boy.
And Diane Ladd. Diane Ladd, she played Flo in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. And, you know, those are landmark movie roles from the 70s. And if you get a chance, you and your listeners should go on YouTube and look at the clip from when Ingrid Bergman won the Oscar. And she gets up, and you can tell that she knows that she shouldn't have won.
Right.
She thanks the Academy, and she immediately she's so gracious, and she talks about how it's always nice to win an Oscar, but sometimes his timing isn't right. And she goes on and praises one of these other actresses, Valentina Cortese, who was in a Truffaut film. And she said, you know, I apologize. I didn't mean to win. but she's just so gracious. And there's another clip of her from the Mike Douglas show a few years ago on YouTube. And she credits Sidney Lumet for winning her that Oscar. She said, because it was all done in one take, and it's all on her face. And if you do it with the sound off, you can see all the emotions on her face. And is it fair to, you know, to have her compete in such a small role with Madeleine Kahn, who's singing and dancing and doing an accent and, you know,
Lily
comedy? That's right. You can't think of. But I mean, you know, if I can't fault Ingrid Bergman for winning an Oscar. It was her third Oscar, but she may not have deserved it.
Lumet was good at that because, of course, just 2 years later, Beatrice Straight would win an Oscar for her appearance in Network, and it is the shortest performance ever to win an Oscar. I think she's in the movie like 4.5 minutes or something. It's the record for the shortest performance. So, you know, I guess if you were an actor, you want to work with Sidney Lumet, because he is going to draw out the best in you, and he's going to know how to present you in a way that's going to make you look as impressive as possible. I mean, you got to bring the goods, but he's going to help you put it across.
That's right, and Albert Finney was nominated, but he didn't win that year either. And if you look at who he was up against, he was up against Al Pacino in The Godfather 2, Jack Nicholson in Chinatown, Dustin Hoffman in Lenny, and they all lost to, believe it or not, Art Carney, who won for a movie called Harry and Tonto, which is a great movie, but I mean, you know, up against Jake Gittes and Michael Corleone and all these other ones. Oh, my God. Lenny Bruce.
I mean, I can't argue not giving it to Finney, but boy, again, he is so great in this movie. I mean, he's just so fun. And, you know, again, back to Lumet. I mean, after, first of all, the end of this, I'm jumping all around here because, like, I have so much to say about this movie still. I'm just trying to keep it coherent. But, like, I love that at the end of this movie, you literally have Martin Balsam telling a room full of high-priced stars, everybody shut up. Don't talk while Poirot explains the case. And he has this whole thing where he says, I have two theories of the case. One, very simple. It's a fellow mobster that was getting revenge on Rossetti, And he snuck onto the train. We have the empty uniform. He snuck onto the train. He killed the guy, and he snuck off. That's the end. And everybody's like, is that it? And he's like, well, no, I do have a second version. And this speech goes on, I think, for something like 20 minutes of screen time where it's just Finney talking to a room full of high-priced stars, none of whom get to say anything.
No, and it must have taken forever to film because you have to get everyone's different angle and everyone's reaction. And, you know, these people aren't used to sitting there for, I'm sure, hours and days on end while someone is reciting these same lines at them over and over again. But it's a masterful scene. I mean, where he lays everything out and, you know, about the grease on the passport and who was walking down in that dragon kimono, and it all fits. You know, you wouldn't think it all fits, but it does. So it's a tremendous scene. It goes and it goes by fast.
Yeah.
You said like it's 20 minutes, but he lays it all out and there you go. And then he's got him.
Yeah, there's a great anecdote from Michael York, who we really haven't mentioned so far really much. And he's great in this movie, Count and Drenny. But he has this anecdote about shooting that scene where he says that it is not fair to your fellow actor if you don't give your full performance back to the actor, even if you yourself are not on screen. So he was talking about that whole thing where Albert Finney had to do that 20-25 minute summation, and he had to do it 8 or 9 times, because you just mentioned he had to do, okay, he's got to give, you know, we're going to do the master shot of him doing it and walking up and down and telling everybody. Then we have to have him giving his lines specifically to Lauren Bacall. We have to have his lines to Vanessa Redgrave, his lines to Jacqueline Bisset. And so, you know, you've got Michael York saying, even though I'm not seen on screen, when Finney is talking to me, I have to be in character. I have to be giving back to him, or it's not fair. I'm being a lousy actor. And I thought,
that's true.
That's amazing to be able to know that you're not on screen, but you still have to go full out, because otherwise you're robbing Albert Finney of his motivation a little bit.
No, you're right. There's a famous, slightly off the track, there's a famous, that famous scene in On the Waterfront where Marlon Brando does the I Could Have Been the Contender
speech.
In the
back of the cab,
It was in the back of the cab. When it was Rod Steiger's turn to give his dialogue, Brando left. He had to go to see his analyst or something or other. But so it's some script girl reading Brando's part. And supposedly Rod Steiger never forgave him for that. 35 years later, you know, God damn it, you know, he left, and you know, but that's true. I mean, these people were professionals, and they knew what it meant. And if you know, you're getting paid, and if you're just sitting there, well, just sit there and listen like you're supposed to.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. and Lumet organizes this wonderful thing where again, and he talks about in this documentary, where at the end of the film, where the murder has been revealed, and we find that it's really Bacall and Bisset are sort of the two main drivers of this whole thing, because we've run out that they're mother and daughter. And the rest of the cast, which has now been exonerated because Poirot basically says, look, this guy, Ricchetti, was a scum, and he was dispatched like the scum that he was, and we're going to, now that the train is free, the snow is cleared on the tracks, we are going to present a fait accompli, as Martin Balsam says, that no, we're going to give them the fake story. So all these people are going to be complicit in this murder, including Poirot, which is kind of amazing, really. You think about it, you've got your main character basically saying, I'm going to cover for all you people. And all the other characters have a glass of champagne, and they all walk up to Lauren Bacall and Jacqueline Bisset and either kiss them on the cheek or tink their champagne glass or hug them or give them a wink. And Lumet described it as a curtain call. He says, this is a very theatrical movie, so we're going to give all the actors a curtain call. And the way the shot is composed, we are behind Bacall and Bisset, so we see the back of their heads, and all the other actors file in, practically look in the camera, do a little tink of the glass, and walk off. And it really is like the most sort of proscenium arch kind of way of ending your movie as possible.
No, it's the perfect ending, and you see them like they've all relaxed a little bit. They've gotten away with it. And you know, the other thing that's interesting about this final sequence here is we don't get a scene like you do in most of these murder mysteries, is where the person confesses and yes, this is how I did it. And Lauren Bacall just sort of sits there and takes it, and she, you know, she's slumped in her chair, and she doesn't, you know, she doesn't give much of a reaction. I'm glad we did it. It's just there. In the novel, what happens is that Mrs. Hubbard pleads with Poirot to just say that I did it. Let everyone else go, and I'll take the rap for it. It was my granddaughter, and I'll be glad to do it. And there are a couple of pages where they explain how they all got on the train and how McQueen got the job, and you know how the butler ended up with him. They explain that, but it's just perfect. You know, you've got that scene where they all take their bow, and it's a nice compliment to the scene when they're all coming in and stabbing him. You know, I mean, it's just, I love that scene. There's that when John Gielgud plunges the knife in Richard Widmark, and it's almost like a Hamlet kind of thing or a Shakespearean thing where he draws the knife out. It's just great that they did these things all in one, and it's all in one take.
Yep.
You know, they're just clicking their glasses, but it's a nice send off, and Poirot is gone, but they're the focus. It's not Poirot. It's what these people did and why they did it, and they loved Lauren Bacall and the Armstrongs so much that it was worth taking the risk. So yeah. It's a perfect ending.
Yeah, and so we get a nice final shot of Poirot as he's watching this, and he walks out of the cabin and he shuts the door behind him, and that's it. That's his final scene. He said, "This is just such a delightful movie. I just love it to death." And I'm not expecting the Branagh version to be anything close to it, because it's just, you know, that movie, the movie made in the 70s, the golden age of Hollywood was still existing in the 70s. It was older, but you still had people like Lauren Bacall and Ingrid Bergman still around, still active, Connery still very vital. You don't have that. Again, the cast that Branagh has assembled is very impressive, but it's nothing like what you had in the 70s.
No.
And that's not his fault. Time has moved on.
I've gone to that Turner Classic Movie Festival a couple of times, and when a star walks into a room or shows up on screen, it's like a jolt.
Yeah.
You know, I was at what like Sophia Loren walked in the room. Oh my God!
Mm-hmm.
You know, or I can only imagine for these people on this film crew. You know, Ingrid Bergman and Sean Connery are sitting there, and there's Lauren Bacall, and you know, the 1970s had a lot of these all-star movies, The Towering Inferno and
yep.
The Poseidon Adventure, and some of these other things, but pound for pound, this has got to be the greatest cast of all time, and that's how they sold the movie. You know, the who's who and whodunits, and it's like you said, it's not probably the most well known film, but for what it is, it's perfect.
Yeah, I'm sincere, and maybe if anything else, what the remake does was it will shine light on this original. It will remind people,
right.
Hey, there's this original out there, and you can watch one of the great actors of all time, Albert Finney, give a really wonderfully comedic performance surrounded by all these all-stars. And so
yeah.
I'm going into the remake just entertain me, just be fun. Give me some wit, give me some laughs, and get, you know, present the mystery like it's a real mystery, like it's got some real stakes here, but I also know this is just meant to be fun. And that's all that I really hope from it. So, but anyway, this Murder on the Orient Express, man, great movie. You said you can get it on iTunes. It is available on DVD. So if you haven't seen it, go check it out. So Chuck, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this. I mentioned this to you like 9 months ago. And so I've been waiting all this time until the remake came out. So thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you. I think in one of your posts on your website, you mentioned about the smudge on the passport or something. Well, I said, who else knows that reference?
Right.
The grease spot on the passport. You know?
The grease spot on the passport, yes.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I said, I'm always happy to talk to you, and I'm always thrilled to read your comments. You always comment on what we're doing over on the network, and it's always fun to talk to you. So, again, thank you for doing this, and we'll have to compare notes about the remake, just offhand, just to see what we both thought of the.
It's a challenge to your listeners. Can you figure out who done it without the spoilers? See if you can figure it out.
Exactly.
I couldn't the first time. I don't think.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Well, thanks for listening. Of course, you want to find back episodes of our show. It's over on the network site, fireandwaterpodcast.com, and we're talking about movies always over on Twitter, which is at Film and Water Pod. So thanks everybody for listening, and until next week, that's a wrap.
The ending of the movie, the scene where they toast Lauren Bacall, I thought a lot about it. First of all, I didn't think it was quite satisfactory just for Poirot to give the solution. And they all sigh, and he leaves. I thought it needed another emotional step. I never know what an audience is going to do, but I know what I'm feeling. And I knew that I had by then invested so much in terms of what these people had done and how ingenious it had all been, the brilliance of their plotting and so on, and the effort involved. The whole experience had been so theatrical. And I thought, I know what we need. We need a curtain call, like in the theater. It would be lovely to see each one of these people untense, because from their first entrances, they are all like that, because they're getting on board this train to kill a guy. To see them untense, happy. All of them did it out of a genuine affection for this woman. And I thought, I know what. We'll have some champagne served, and we'll have them each come up to her and toast her. And that's what we did.